Hi, this is Sav,
Katie,
and Caitlin
from The Accidentals. You're listening to your morning coffee podcast with our friends Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchert.
Weekly music news for the new music business.
From Ari Herstand for Variety, artists are seeing their music removed from DSPs for streaming fraud they didn't commit.
From Music Business Worldwide, Spotify plans to let subscribers speed up songs and pay rights holders when those modified tracks are streamed.
And from Billboard, everyone wants to reach superfans, but it won't be easy. Well, we got stuff to talk about then. If that's not going to be easy, I thought it was easy, Jay, but apparently it is not. There have been some ghosts in the machine this morning as Jay and I have been futzing around with our gear, but we think we have it dialed in and ready to go. So we are going to push the start button right about now.
Stand by for transmission.
This is London calling.
Wake up! The revolution is at hand!
Your morning coffee is on the air.
Your morning coffee, the weekly music news for the new music business. It's the highly curated, agitated, advocated, moderated, and liberated digital music information that you need to know. We are your digital music authority. And now, from our studios in Hollywood, California, here's your hosts, Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart.
Always an angel, never a god. Always an angel, never God, always an angel, never a God. 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 Always an angel. I don't know why I am the way I am. There's something in the static.
Afternoon, Jay. We've been on an adventure this morning, trying to kind of troubleshoot some of our gear here, and we're back to the way it was, so we're good, I think. Famous last words.
It's fine. Look, we've been doing a lot of this. We're coming up on episode number 200, and we're not going to spoil the surprise, but we have a fantastic guest for our episode number 200. But before we start, how about that intro by The Accidentals? And that song, Not Strong Enough, that's a Boy Genius track that we just played you their version of. It's from an upcoming release of Cover Tunes, aptly titled Cover Art, and that'll be out May 10th. This is the third track that they've released from that release. First one was Heart of Glass, the Blondie classic.
The Blondie song.
Yeah, Green and Gold by Leanne Mahavas, which is fantastic. So, anyway, I just absolutely love the vocals on that. Great job.
Oh, it's great. It's a great song, Not Strong Enough. Great. I mean, I like the original version. I like their version. It's just, it is fantastic. And you, both you and I are really suckers for great harmonies. Oh my God. And, you know, it's just, oh, it's just, it gives you goosebumps when you hear just powerful, great harmonies. So that got some goosebumps on that. By the way, Record Store Day is this Saturday, April 20th. It's coming. That's not this Saturday. That's next Saturday, I should say. This coming Saturday, April 20th. Check out the list and make your plans. We've got the complete list in the Your Morning Coffee newsletter. They've announced their 2024 official list of music to celebrate the culture of the independently owned record store. The celebration includes exclusive vinyl, performances, meet and greets, and so much more. And this event is just gigantic. I mean, gosh.
It's I can't miss Record Store Day. We have a release Record Store Day. We have this Ann Wilson and Trip Sitter live. It is fantastic. Cool. Limited edition, so get yours while you can. There was a really interesting guest post, a guest column in Billboard this week by Jeanette Barrios. And the headline was, How to Create an Effective Women's Mentorship Program in the Music Business. And if you haven't checked that out, it is really, really well written. And again, that's a guest column by Jeanette Barrios that was in Billboard this last week. Really great.
Yeah, check it out. And then, interestingly enough, this week, Taylor Swift's music is back on TikTok, but despite no resolution in its dispute with UMG. This was from Music Business Worldwide. Swift's music has started reappearing on TikTok. I've got marbles in my mouth this morning, Jay. I'm sorry. Despite the fact there's been no movement in the ongoing licensing dispute between the social media platform and Universal Music Group, with whom Swift has both recording and publishing agreements, but yet it's up. And I believe she controls her masters, which is why she has the power.
That's right. That's right. So how is this happening? Given the details of the recording contracts and publishing agreements are rarely made public, that's a matter of speculation, especially given that at least so far, UMG isn't talking. Variety, though, they speculate that TikTok likely reached a separate deal with Taylor Swift, as you mentioned, as she owns, you know, her own master recordings.
Very interesting. I was not surprised, but that kind of made me go, oh, when I saw that. I wonder if there were conversations that were had between UMG and she.
I'm sure. I think you can count on that. And there were a couple of stories in your morning coffee this week, because it was surprising that someone at her level would be putting music on TikTok because of, you know, this Universal thing. But there were a couple of articles about, well, she's got a new album coming and she's positioning herself, that's easy for you to say, for that. So we'll be watching this space closely.
For sure. Well, being the music documentary freaks that we are, Jay, interesting to see there's a new Indigo Girls documentary hitting theater. It hit theaters last week, actually, for just one night only. There's a digital release that will follow on May 7th. They released their debut album, Strange Fire, back in 1987. Okay, that's not making me feel young, because I remember that when it came out. They led with a sense of fearlessness that was something of a rarity at the time. Back then, there were very few artists that were out, very few. People feared for their careers in those days, and I'm really looking forward to this.
I am too. This is going to be, you and I love music documentaries, and I'm really excited. I'm such a huge fan, and believe it or not, back in 1987, I was working at Tower Records, and we were invited to a listening party, and the crew at my tower, we went to this hotel, and we were in this hotel room, and the Indigo Girls played for us in this hotel room. And we were stunned. I mean, just the harmonies and the songs, and it was just so amazing. We were absolutely blown away. Anyway, career highlight, love the Indigo Girls. Can't wait for that documentary.
Closer to Fine is on my desert island song list. So it's such
by the way, we were talking about the Accidentals, you know, doing that cover art album. That's one of the songs that's on that.
Oh, do they? Oh, gosh. Oh, good, good, good call. Good call on their part. Well, Jay, before we start, we must thank our wonderful sponsors. The Your Morning Coffee podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website, an online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. All the features you need to design an EPK are already built in, including a fully customizable templates, preset EPK page layouts, music players, images, text, bio, and video embeds, a gig calendar and press quotes, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and Your Morning Coffee podcast listeners can go over to Bandzoogle.com to try it free for 30 days, then use the promo code MORNINGCOFFEE Coffee EPK, that's all one word, to get 10% off the first year of the new EPK plan subscription. That's bandzoogle.com. Promo code Morning Coffee EPK when you sign up to the EPK plan.
Yeah, I love those guys. We're also brought to you by Hypebot. Since 2004, Hypebot has chronicled the new music industry and the trends and technologies that are changing how music is discovered, consumed, marketed, and monetized. Edited daily by founder Bruce Houghton with help from Alana Bonilla, Hypebot and sister blog Music Think Tank are published by live music discovery and marketing platform Bands in Town.
Indeed, Bands in Town, over 80 million live music fans trust Bands in Town to get personalized concert alerts, recommendations, and messages from their favorite artists. It's the number one artist service platform, connecting over 590,000 artists with their super fans. Managers, labels, agencies, and artists access their own dashboard to manage and promote their tour dates across all platforms.
Yes, sir. And finally, the Music Business Association, their conference, the Music Biz Conference 2024, that creates the rooms in which important conversations that shape the future of our industry take place. Representing more than 90% of the music business at large, the Music Business Association serves as the connective tissue for the global music business and provides a trusted forum where ideas and collaboration can flourish. It really does. Join us for the Music Biz 2024 conference. It's coming up here really quickly, May 13th through the 16th in beautiful Nashville, Tennessee. I'll be moderating a panel with some very, very smart people. And I hope you come by and say hi.
Indeed. Big Band Zoogle, Hypebot, Bands in Town, and the Music Business Association. Thanks to each one of them. We certainly appreciate that. And of course, every week I get to hang out with the beautifully voiced individual. He is Jay Gilbert, a music industry consultant. He is the curator of the Your Morning Coffee newsletter and a former executive with Universal Music, Sony Music, and Warner Music Groups.
Really, I have a face for radio. And I get to do this show every single week with my good friend Mike Etchart. It's the highlight of my week. It really is. Longtime host of Sound and Vision Radio, formerly of SST Records, Warner Music, Capital EMI, and Universal Music Group. And we always have great conversations surrounding music. We typically talk for an hour or so before we hit record. You know, it covers every single thing you could even imagine. And one day we decided we would just hit record on some of these conversations. Yeah, and again, yes. it's just so much fun. So we're going to jump into the stories. The first one is from our friend Ari Herstand. He writes a column once in a while for Variety, which is awesome. And the headline was, "Artists are seeing their music removed from DSPs for streaming fraud they didn't commit." And we talked about this a little bit, I think last week or the week before, that he had reached out to some artists to get some stories, because we keep hearing these stories, and we know of people who have had their music flagged because they've been accused of using bots, spin farms, or just, you know, in some ways trying to manipulate the stream count. So as Ari says, you know, on February 9th, the electronic artist Ben Jordan, who performs under the alias Flashbulb, he was attempting to reference one of his songs during a recording session, but he couldn't access his music on Spotify or Tidal. He thought at first that his phone was glitching, and then he began receiving messages from fans asking why he'd removed all of his music from streaming platforms. Not surprisingly, panic set in.
Yeah, no kidding. Jordan, who to date has earned more than $500,000 in streaming royalties and relies on them for a significant part of his income, had been unwittingly caught up in streaming services' new crackdown on fraud. TuneCore, his distributor, had received a notice from Spotify indicating that significant artificial streaming activity had been detected on his music. TuneCore summarily removed all 23 of his albums from all streaming platforms without warning.
Streaming fraud is one of the most serious problems facing the music industry today, you know, because most streaming platforms operate on that pro rata payment model that we talk about a lot, in which payment is based on an artist's total share or share of total streams. I mean, fraudsters have managed to steer millions of dollars away from legitimate artists, songwriters, labels, and publishers. And because DIY distributors like TuneCore and DistroKid, they allow virtually anyone to distribute unlimited audio files to streaming platforms for around $20 a year, at a volume that is extremely difficult to police effectively, the barrier to entry is virtually non-existent. And Ari says, note, the warning about a violation in Spotify policies that he pictured in this article is from DistroKid. So you have to check out this article in Variety. Look at the different screen captures that he has. It'll help flow the story.
Yeah, absolutely. So artists that use DIY distributors like these collectively earned $1.8 billion in 2023, representing just over 5% of the total market share of the global recorded music industry. That's according to music research firm Midia. Spotify announced last year the biggest shift to its payment structure since its inception. In an attempt to combat streaming fraud and get more of the revenue to emerging and professional artists, that's in quotation marks, it will not issue royalties for tracks that accrue fewer than 1,000 streams annually, and will fine distributors $10 for every track that it is detected accruing significant numbers of artificial streams. With DistroKid estimating that it distributes nearly 30 to 40,000 songs every day, and TuneCore not far behind, this has significant consequences. While there are plenty of distributors that cater to independent artists and labels, DistroKid and TuneCore have taken the most aggressive approach.
Yeah, TuneCore CEO Andrea Gleason and VP of Artist Support Erica Clayton revealed the pressure that they're under from streaming services, which led them to implement these admittedly aggressive policies. As part of the newly formed Music Fights Fraud Alliance, TuneCore is in support of Spotify fines. However, Gleason says that TuneCore will be implementing a warning system moving forward.
So in a statement, Gleason tells Variety, in order to effectively prevent bad actors from diluting the royalty pool for real artists with real fans, all companies need to be a part of the solution, she writes. To safeguard legitimate artists, TuneCore diligently removes content reported by DSPs for high rates of fraudulent streaming activity. Despite best efforts, some legitimate artists have become victims of malicious streaming fraud or been taken advantage of by fraudsters masquerading as digital marketing or promotional companies. We are actively refining our policies and practices in order to foster an equitable streaming landscape, empowering all artists to thrive, end quote.
Okay, so DistroKid, on the other hand, they've implemented a strike system by which artists are notified that Spotify has reported significant artificial streaming activity on their music. The distributor advises the artist to cease promotional activity, assuming that the artist is responsible for those streaming violations, or if the artist is unaware of the fraudulent activity, they are advised to remove the track from Spotify or face fines or an outright ban. The artists then are required to answer a series of questions before being allowed to access their account and their funds, by the way, to indicate they understand how the violations took place.
So singer-songwriter Jonah Baker, who became popular with acoustic covers on YouTube, now makes around $200,000 annually from streaming revenue and has had over 150 million streams across multiple platforms. He received a strike notice from DistroKid indicating significant artificial streams on his music, but he says he has no idea why. He wasn't paying any service to boost his streams. DistroKid's customer service support advised him to remove the track or face a ban, so he removed it in the hope it wouldn't happen with any of his other music.
Wow. DistroKid's language in these notices indicates that that is due to Spotify's policy, and then requires the artist to affirm via a quiz and checkboxes that they won't use any promotional program aimed specifically at Spotify. But a rep for Spotify denied the platform has any strike or warning system and does not require artists to remove songs in these instances. A Spotify spokesperson said in a statement to Variety, quote, "When Spotify identifies and confirms artificial streams, we withhold royalties from those streams and report the activity to the label or distributor. Spotify does not tell labels and distributors to remove content from our platform, but they may enforce their own removal policies. We're working to quickly remove playlists and high levels and artificial streams as we continue our efforts to minimize the impact of stream manipulation across our platform," end quote.
Well, however, DistroKid offers its own promotional service for users on a plan that costs $89.99 per year. Its Playlister feature enables artists to find contract information for third-party user-generated Spotify playlist editors, which is often a link to a company called SubmitHub. That company is a platform where third-party playlist curators charge a few dollars to listen to a track and consider including it on their playlist. The more popular the playlist appears, the more submissions the curator gets and the more money they make. Although platforms like SubmitHub are not technically against Spotify's terms of service because the playlisters charge for consideration, not inclusion, it is widely known that many of these playlists are fraught with bot activity that is likely to cause artificial streams.
We've used SubmitHub before, and one of the benefits is that you also get someone's opinion on your track, which can be helpful. So although SubmitHub publicly states, quote, "We vet and verify all of our curators before granting them access to the platform," end quote, problematic playlist curators still manage to slip through. SubmitHub founder Jason Grishkoff, he explained, "Playlisters apply to join SubmitHub and then go through a review process where we try to identify anything that might compromise an artist on Spotify. And part of that is checking whether they charge for placement. If you're willing to charge money for a playlist placement, you're probably willing to buy fake plays and followers," end quote.
So Viper, an artist who uses DistroKid for distribution, had her song removed with a notice from the company indicating 100% artificial streams on her track Fusion. The song had been included in official Spotify editorial and algorithmic playlists, generating nearly 14,000 streams over several weeks. Before it was removed by DistroKid, it seems highly improbable that 100% of the streams for a track included on official Spotify playlists would be artificial.
Contacted by Variety, DistroKid president Phil Bauer, he responded, and he said, "DistroKid is required to follow the rules and policies set by streaming services. Streaming services typically do not disclose their fraud management policies, as that would make the policies easier to evade," right? And they deferred to Spotify all questions regarding the company's playlists.
Interestingly, so erroneous takedown notices aren't limited to DIY artists. Artist manager Seth Callen of This Fiction, whose clients include ex-ambassadors, Tours, and Jukebox the Ghost, was contacted by a friend at Spotify regarding his artist Bloom Twins, warning that the company had detected significant artificial streaming activity on their account, even though the group had songs included in official Spotify editorial and algorithmic playlists. Callen swears that no one in his camp paid for artificial streams, although they did submit music to a few playlist editors over at SubmitHub.
Right. Multiple other artists and managers interviewed for this article by Ari, they've been the target of multiple bot attacks, which generated massive amounts of artificial streams and fake followers. All of them were knowledgeable and tried to play by the rules posted by Spotify and the distributors, while also promoting their music in legitimate ways. Their only recourse was to notify their distributors and Spotify that they were aware of the attacks and had done nothing to invite them, including paying for artificial streams or hiring a playlisting service, and hope neither the distributor nor the streamers removes their music.
So although distributors and streaming services frequently use language that places the blame on the artist for fraudulent activity detected on their accounts, it has become clear that artists are often caught in the middle of a crossfire between streaming services, distributors, and fraudsters attempting to game the system for their own financial gain. While it's understandable that some artists are trying to skirt the rules, the solution to streaming fraud should not come at the expense of innocent artists.
Yeah.
This great is, piece by Ari. Oh,
yeah, oh, Ari Herstand, kudos. Really, really great piece. And if you don't already, you know, listen to his podcast or check out, you know, his blog, Ari's Take, always really good stuff. We dig Ari. The thing that surprises me here is that, you know, if you're trying to play by the rules and you're, you know, designated as using bots or spin farms or in some way trying to jack up the numbers, there's got to be some recourse, some way that, like, as Ari points out in the article, some of these artists and their songs were, they claimed that they were getting 100%, you know, artificial streams, yet they were you know, Release Radar, Discover Weekly. They were on some DSP curated playlist, Spotify curated playlist. So that couldn't really be true. I'm wondering if a company like BeatDap, who is so good at, you know, finding streaming fraud, if there's a way, and maybe they're already partnering with companies like BeatDap to make sure that the streams are actually fraudulent. But look, it's a tough thing when people are out there trying to game this system. And we've read that at minimum, it's probably 10% of the streams that happen are fraudulent. Some people claim it's double that. And you had mentioned in his article, you know, this new Spotify policy where under 1,000 plays that you're not being paid for.
Get paid.
Right? No. And if you look at the latest Luminate report, 86% of the music that's out right now, which is 184 million ISRC codes, 86% is streamed 1,000 or less. So it's, you know, it's really, really crazy. I'm glad that Ari wrote this article and hopefully some action will be taken because of it. And we know he'll follow up. But once again, fantastic piece that Ari wrote for Variety.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So let's jump into our second story. This is from Music Business Worldwide. Murray Stassen, fantastic writer over there. He writes another one. The headline is Spotify plans to let subscribers speed up songs and pay rights holders when those modified tracks are streamed. So manipulated audio is a big problem today because some of it can't be tracked. You know, when they speed something up, slow it down, reverb it. And then a lot of times people will put it up under their own name and not under the artist. And so they're not being remunerated. There's that word again. And manipulated audio, just, you know, for our audience, those are tracks that have been sped up, slowed down, otherwise tweaked before being uploaded to DSPs. And it's becoming a major story for the record company this year.
Right. So in February, PEX published a study that analyzed 100 million audio tracks on TikTok and estimated that comfortably more than a third, actually almost 40% of all songs found on the platform were speed or pitched modified in 2023. Not only that, but PEX estimated that the share of tracks on TikTok that are modified is increasing. It's up from about 25% in 2022 to almost 40%, 38.03% actually, in 2023.
Wow, 38%. That's crazy. In a bid to compete with the popularity of such modified audio on TikTok, Spotify now is reportedly working on a feature that could let its users speed up or slow down versions of songs. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which, citing sources, reported this last week that Spotify hopes the plan will, quote, appeal to young users while generating new revenue for artists. I'd love to know what you feel about that, Mike. Like, if you're a recording artist, you record your song the way you want it to be. What do you feel about somebody speeding it up, slowing it down, reverbing it?
Well, and I think it's sort of a generational thing too. It's like, you know, I think I don't dig it. If that was my stuff, I'd be kind of bent out of shape. But I understand that is something that users like to do, and I suppose it's a thing. And on some level, when you release it into the wild, you can no longer control it. So that is certainly. So as per the source cited by the Wall Street Journal, music rights holders would be paid for streams of the user-edited versions of tracks on the platform. It added, however, that discussions about the tools are early and licensing agreements have yet to be worked out.
I love the fact that they're at least talking about these things. This is so unlike the music industry. We typically like to kill innovations and technology. Right. So the reported plans, they could entail letting listeners save songs that have been modified using the new tool to like virtual collections on the platform, but they won't be able to share those versions of songs on platforms outside of Spotify, and that is key. So according to the Wall Street Journal, the basic elements of Spotify's song modification features will be accessible by the platform's $10.99 per month premium subscribers.
Meanwhile, added the Wall Street Journal, more advanced song modification tools could be a feature of Spot's rumored super premium tier. That tier, as previously reported, could also offer 24-bit lossless music, a higher monthly subscription price of $19.99 per month. So
we like
to be paid for those. That's right.
Yeah. So while Spotify reportedly hashes out the ability for users to legally modify tracks directly on his platform, the phenomenon of unlicensed modified tracks, whether created by users for fun or uploaded to user-generated content platforms like TikTok, or deliberately by bad actors to commit streaming fraud, that has become a major headache for rights holders.
Yeah, in January, Rasty Turek, the founder and CEO of PEX, told us on the Music Business Worldwide podcast that there are over 1 million manipulated tracks available on audio streaming services. These manipulated tracks are what PEX calls modified audio, original tracks that have been sped up, slowed down, or otherwise manipulated, and then uploaded to DSPs as entirely new recordings.
That's right. And unless these million-plus tracks have legally licensed the original recording, you know, from which they're based, they're infringing copyright. This doesn't only affect music streaming. It also, you know, UGC or user-generated content, social platforms like TikTok, you know, as highlighted by PEX's study, which was published in February.
Right. So rising in popularity, modified audio remixes often divert royalty payments away from rights holders and into the hands of other creators, says PEX. Many of these songs aren't licensed. As such, the ownership information for them directs to the creator of the modified track, not to any of the original rights holders.
That's a huge problem. Without a license or proper attribution, rights holders won't see any credit or payment for the use of these songs. Just a couple of weeks ago, rapper Trefago was ordered to pay the court over $800,000 in damages to Sony Music for using unlicensed sample in its TikTok hit 90 Miles Per Hour.
Right, so it features a sped-up key violin motif from a track called Reflections by Japanese composer Toshifumi Hinata, which Sony Music Entertainment owns copyrights in the sound recording, while Sony Music publishing copyrights cover the composition.
Yeah, that was a big fine. Also reported last month, despite Universal Music Group pulling its official catalog from TikTok, there remain stacks of manipulated versions of UMG recordings on the ByteDance platform, typically uploaded by users as quote-unquote sounds.
As we explained in this widely shared story between February 1st and March 14th, when the story was published, Universal Music Group had hit TikTok with over 37,000 separate copyright takedown requests to remove different sounds from the platform.
Wow, 37,000 takedown requests. And that resulted in approximately 120 million videos, you know, on TikTok that were being muted. The majority of those takedowns targeted sped up, slowed down, pitched up, pitched down versions of original recordings of UMG-controlled music uploaded by TikTok users.
Because the audio of these tracks is modified, they often bypass TikTok's copyright detection filters, the same copyright detection filters that would automatically block users from uploading the videos featuring unmodified Universal tracks. So under the condition of anonymity, a source told us that internally, UMG is calling its TikTok modified audio copyright takedown effort Project Time Out. So man, oh man, oh man, a lot of interesting stuff. But you know, I mean, it's just such an overwhelming amount of stuff, A, and the tools that are available to anybody and everybody, B, are just out there. I mean, it's super easy to modify all this stuff. It's really, and with all these tools now that I've been messing around with, having a lot of fun with, where you can break everything down into stems, just a regular track. You can pull out the piano parts. You can pull out the vocals. It's just unbelievably fast and quick and fun and easy and sounds great. And you can just basically create a new song simply or by just separating out the tracks, and all the tools are available. And wow.
And that's the thing, is it is all of those things that you described. And that's because fans today, they're not content to be the fans that we were back in the day and sit back and read the liner notes, mm-hmm, as they listen to the album. they want to contact their favorite artists through socials and through their website. They want to have experiences where they can meet them and have their photograph taken with them. They want to participate in the art by speeding it up, slowing it down, reverbing it, all of that stuff. They want to participate. And again, whether we agree or disagree with that, I love the fact that we're, as an industry, we're starting to look at that and provide those tools and find a safe space where that can be done, because it's going to get done anyway. And you might as well sort of have some guardrails up. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, and it takes me back to our early days at Universal. We were talking like 20 plus years ago, and we were seeing people coming in with these concepts, these ideas. The tools hadn't really caught up yet. But this concept has been around for a very long time. But man, it's super simple now. So here we are.
Yeah, and which leads us beautifully into our last story today, which is about super fans, and it's from one of our favorite writers, Elias Late, over at Billboard. And the headline grabbed everybody this week. Everyone wants to reach super fans. It won't be easy. Labels, streamers, and promoters, they want to get super fans to spend more money, each with a different approach. Which will be more effective? I mean, they love artists. They love, you know, they've got money to burn, and they're the music industry's new obsession. Basically, you know, say hello to the super fans.
In January alone, Warner Music Group CEO Robert Kyncl called for stoking the blue flames of superfans and additional direct artist superfan products and experiences. Universal Music Group CEO Lucian Grange highlighted the value of superfan experiences and products, and Spotify hinted at future superfan clubs in a blog post.
Right. The following month, leaders at Interscope, Live Nation, they shouted out superfans. You know, we've been hearing this a lot. That was all before Jun Choi, president of the Korean fan platform Weverse. By the way, you got to check out Weverse. Listen to Music Business Worldwide's last podcast. They talk about Weverse. Yes. Fascinating stuff. So anyway, Korean platform Weverse one-upped everyone by telling Music Business Worldwide that the potential for growth in the superfan business is in that economy is limitless. Stoke those blue flames right, and they'll never stop burning.
All this runaway enthusiasm about superfans goes back to that Goldman Sachs article, says Mike Begain, former UMG executive and founder of Big Effect, which is developing technology designed to help smaller artist teams. Last summer, the financial institution posted that superfans, Luminate defines this group as listeners who engage with artists and their content in 5+ different ways, could inject more than $4 billion into the music industry by 2030.
I'd never heard that before. Engage artists and their content in 5+ different ways. And that's how they're saying, you know, this is a super fan. And you and I are super fans. We talk about it all the time. There's certain artists that we will go see them live every time they come. We will purchase their merch. We will do whatever they tell us to do. Goldman's report also noted that the music business struggles to fully monetize its content. Nearly everyone listens to music, but the industry's value pales next to that of gaming, for example. Games have been more agile in terms of innovating and adopting ways to generate new revenue streams, says Ben Sumner, managing director at Feel for Music, which helps games and brands and music supervision.
But for labels and streaming services, collecting new revenue from superfans may be easier said than done. People are trying to find a simple way to mine fandom, says Mike Pelosinski, one of the architects of SoundCloud's fan-powered royalties, a payout system that aligns streaming revenue more closely with fandom. It's good for investors to hear, but it's not simple. Every platform is different.
Yeah, not only that, so much of the conversation is about how to extract more out of the superfan, which he says is a big mistake. And that's from Bernie Cahill, founding partner of Activist Artist Management. He says, if you take care of them, you'll get far more value out of that relationship than you will by selling them another piece of vinyl or T-shirt.
Pelsinski believes that superfans want to be closer to and most importantly seen by their favorite artist. They also clearly gain from their connections with like-minded enthusiasts, working together to orchestrate fundraising campaigns to support the acts they love. For example, Luminate found that superfans are 43% more likely than the average listener to say they like to participate in the community that springs up and around an act. These communities are defined by artist-to-fan and fan-to-fan relationships. It's not immediately clear where labels can squeeze in.
It's also notable that historically, labels actually excel at reaching passive fans. A record label is unmatched when it comes to taking a song that's connecting with audiences in one space and making it so ubiquitous that it becomes inescapable. That kind of thing that casual listeners run into at the gym or the supermarket. We can reach Fall Out Boy's super fans pretty easily, says Jonathan Daniel, co-founder of Crush Management. You know, they have, Miley Cyrus, Sia, Green Day, Panic, etc. Anyway, he says, when they have a song that raises its hand above the super fans, different opportunities come for them. And that's where you really need the label. They're great at taking it really wide.
So these days, due to the fact that artists can record, distribute, and market themselves on the cheap, they usually amass a dedicated following before they even sign to a label. This tends to give them a lot of sway in contract negotiations, and as a result, 360 deals, that's where labels take a share of the money that artists make from touring and merchandising sales, for example, are out of favor with young managers and lawyers, limiting record companies' ability to cash in on superfans' passion.
Nonetheless, to the extent that labels can encourage superfans to stream more or buy additional vinyl variants, they stand to gain financially. All the major labels also own merch companies. So if they can stoke demand for t-shirts that are subsequently manufactured by their own outlets, that's another win. And UMG recently invested in Weverse and Network's acquisition of Complex, allowing it to benefit indirectly from super fandom.
So Warner has another plan altogether. In February, Kinsel said that he's assembled a team of incredible technology talent, that's in quotation marks, to construct an app where artists can connect directly with their superfans. While he hasn't shared any additional details on what this will look like, users would presumably only have access to Warner artists on a Warner superfan platform. However, most listeners probably also want to connect with some acts signed elsewhere to the extent that they know what labels their favorite artists are even signed to.
That's a good point, because not everybody knows what label. Like, we grew up in an era of, there was Motown, and there were, you knew what label. You knew the Beatles were on Capitol. You knew that stuff. And I'm not so sure that all these superfans know much about the label itself. So the other hurdle that new superfan apps, the streaming platforms trying to add new superfan features, is all the existing options. The majority of artists already try to interact with their most passionate fans on TikTok, Instagram, Discord, Reddit, and many others. As a result, artist time is very scarce, says Roneel Rumberg, co-founder and CEO at Audius. That's a blockchain-based streaming service which enables direct payments to fans to artists last year.
So if more streamers try rolling out superfan features, SoundCloud, for example, allowed acts to message their top fans last year, then artist time will be crunched even further, as each platform will presumably require a different approach to engagement. In fact, Kinsel used exactly this reasoning to justify Warner's venture into platform building. Artists don't want to optimize just for one platform over another, he said.
Yeah, still, despite all the potential obstacles, we're seeing a lot of momentum on the institutional music side to figure out and do this quickly, Rumberg says. Before adding a note of caution, he said, when so many hopes and dreams get injected into one word or concept, there's no way it ever lives up to the hype. And I would encourage everybody to check out Music Watch and Russ Krupnik. He's written some very insightful articles, and one of them is on superfans, and he takes sort of a contrarian view of superfans and is trying to maybe let a little bit of air out of that balloon.
Yeah, very much so. And it's interesting stuff. And again, when you're talking about, asking the artist to do all these things. And this, we, you know, I've talked a lot about the challenge for artists, you know, in an earlier time, all they had to worry about was writing great songs, performing great songs. And now when you lump all of this other stuff in, there's not enough hours in the day. Yeah. So I don't know where that goes for the artist. It's a lot of work. But on that note, we got to wrap up the show. We want to thank everyone for listening. Jay and I certainly appreciate it. And if you would just tell one friend, that would be great. So big thanks to Banzugo, Hypebot Bands in Town of the Music Business Association. And for you, the listener, thanks for checking in with us this week. We appreciate it. And the good news is we'll be back next week as well. So we'll see you then on the Your Morning Coffee Podcast.
You've been listening to Your Morning Coffee, the weekly music news program for the new music business. Join Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchard next time for the digital music news you need to know.